This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
From the New York Times, this is The Run-Up. I'm Michael Barbaro.
For too long, a small group in our nation's capital has reaped the rewards of government while the people have borne the cost. Washington flourished, but the people did not share in its wealth. Politicians prospered, but the jobs left and the factories closed. The establishment protected itself, but not the citizens of our country. Their victories have not been your victories. Their triumphs have not been your triumphs. And while they celebrated in our nation's capital, there was little to celebrate for struggling families all across our land. That all changes, starting right here and right now, because this moment is your moment. It belongs to you.
That's the promise that Donald Trump made at his inauguration in his first address to Americans as the newly sworn-in leader of this country, returning power to the people. That makes this a very particular moment. One that happens every 4 years, often every eight, when a president comes to power but has not yet governed. Their promises and the hopes of the people who put them in the White House will never be greater, because nothing has been tested. Reality has yet to disappoint, as it inevitably does. And here in Washington on the National Mall, it's the people with the greatest hopes who showed up for Trump's inauguration as the 45th president of the United States. So for the last episode of this show with me as your host, before the story permanently moves to Washington, I wanted to hear those hopes, hear from the people who traveled from all over the country to witness this inauguration, and ask what a successful Trump presidency would mean to them. Then we'll look at how those hopes might meet with reality as this period of transition ends and governing begins in the Trump era.
My name is Philip Elmore. This is my wife, Sarah, and we currently live in Tampa, Florida, and I'm a construction manager and
I'm a registered nurse.
We basically want to ask lots of people who came all from all over the country the specific things they want from the Trump presidency and how optimistic they are that he's going to get it done.
Bringing the factories back, bringing work back to our country is in my opinion, prime. Number one thing that he needs to work on, and I think we've already seen that he's doing so.
How optimistic are you that he can bring back the factory jobs in the country that are being lost or that have been lost?
I'm optimistic that he's going to try, and I'm optimistic that if the government will work together, then they can do anything they want to do. The people of the country want to work. We don't want to be on welfare.
Are you somebody who worked a factory job that was affected by the economy in the last decade or two?
Yes and no. I worked in a factory at one point, and then I moved on to other things in my career, and that factory has since closed down. So I have relatives and friends, of course, who have been affected by that. I've had relatives and friends who have been paid to train their Mexican counterparts to take their jobs away from them. And that's a horrible thing.
What about you? What do you want to see the now 10-minute-old president do for you and for your family and your community?
I want to see him continue to express unity. I want to see patriotism. I want to cry when the national anthem is sung. I want it to make me swell tears, and I want to see everyone
like you're on
arm
the verge
arm.
Of crying right now.
I am on the verge of crying because I'm optimistic. I'm eternally hopeful that this country can be what it was when I was growing up, when you stopped and you pitched in together and you worked arm in arm, elbow in elbow. And I really hope that the speech he gave said unity. I just expect him to continue that message on. That's what I want.
I covered his campaign really closely, and at times the campaign message wasn't unity. It was, you know, it was something else. I mean, he could be a very provocative candidate. He is now, as you said, talking mm-hmm. about unity. Do you worry at all that he's going to go back and forth between the candidate Trump and what we just saw here on the steps of the Capitol?
I really don't. I think the thing with the campaign is he was trying to get across you have to be harder on the campaign trail because you're trying to get the issues out. So I do think there were times that he seemed abrasive, but I think he wants the American people to be first and foremost. And you can't take care of the world if you can't take care of yourself. I can't feed my neighbor if I don't have a good job myself.
Jobs, jobs, jobs. I see the pain, seeing patients on a day-to-day basis, understanding their financial needs as well as their health needs, and they don't want the two to be together.
My name is Denise, and I live in Round Hill, Virginia, and I'm past 55, shall I say.
And don't look a day over 54.
And I'm TR, I'm from Round Hill, and I'm past 21, at least twice past 21.
What specifically in your life you hope that now President Donald Trump is going to change and make better?
Well, I'm hoping that he will work on the healthcare issues, because we ourselves haven't been directly affected by it all that much, but we know a lot of people who have. Some people lost their insurance altogether because the company dropped them because they couldn't offer them a policy anymore. And they went to pick up, on their choices to pick up new insurance, the deductibles were so high that they just couldn't. They have a lot of people in their family who get sick quite often, and they couldn't handle the high deductible. And they were very scared that they were going to have to, the only choice would be the Affordable Care Act, and there the deductible for them was even higher.
So you want to see him repeal it pretty quickly?
I want to see him come up with options that are going to be more affordable and provide more choice and not limit so many things on the plan itself. We're seeing a lot more limitations on the plans and what they're going to cover and who they're going to cover.
Is there anything else in your life that you think the president can change, make better?
Well, I'd like to see the job market get a little bit better, because I was laid off of my job almost a year ago, and I really haven't been able to find anything. I've been looking for a job for a long time.
What kind of job was it?
It was an IT job for the federal government. And the reason myself and quite a few others were laid off is because of the budget cut to the contract.
So you work for a defense contractor?
Yes. I worked for a defense contractor for almost 20 years.
You think Donald Trump is going to provide more money to the defense industry, to the military?
He definitely is just going to do that. But I think he's also going to foster jobs in the private sector as well.
What did you do after you lost your job?
Ask my husband for money.
Let me just ask you the different question. Kind of what's the number one thing you want to see the new president do now that he's inaugurated?
Well, I'm a bit more libertarian than he is. I'd like to see things that I don't expect of him, but I would like to see a little less, smaller government and a little more freedom to the people is what I'm hoping for.
I got to ask you a question. Mm-hmm. You want a smaller government. Your wife here wants to make sure she's getting a job from the government. So I'm just trying to reconcile these two things.
This is the nature of life, isn't it?
And marriage.
And look, I'm not against all government, certainly not against defense. It's just that, in general, I think government needs to not be involved in everything.
Are you going to measure success by whether you get a job? That would seem like a fair measurement.
The economy is certainly a part of it all around. Not just her job, but the economy in general.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Well, I want you to enjoy your pretzel and the rest of your day, and thank you guys.
Oh, well, I have kids, so obviously education is key, as is our infrastructure.
So, same question to you. It's been 3 minutes since he's inaugurated, but
now
how
it's
optimistic?
Five.
Now it's five.
I'm very optimistic. What do you want me to give you, a percent? I'm all the way from California.
We want secured borders, absolutely. I mean, that's everything. I mean, if you look at it, there's 35 different camps around America that are holding basically terrorists. You know, they're training them there. We want Trump to end that.
Do you mean sanctuary cities or?
Absolutely. Well, if you like Islamburg.
Terror training camps.
In the United States.
It's all you.
In the United States, terror training camps. Islamburg is the biggest one.
can I ask you, do you want to see the ban on Muslim immigrants that Donald Trump talked about during the campaign, now that he's president? Do you want to see him do that?
It needs to stop right now until there's a vetting process. They got to get a vetting process in place.
So put the ban in until the situation is figured out that meets what you would argue is
like. Absolutely. I mean, we don't have room to put anybody. They're letting people pour in from Mexico. So, I mean, I think people had the wrong idea about the wall. He's not just going to toss everybody out that's not white American or white Christian American. Like, people had the idea that that's the only people that could stay in the country.
Why do you want him to build the wall on the southern border with Mexico?
Because we don't have money. I mean, we don't have any money. He wants to stop criminals. He doesn't want the people to come and steal the jobs for the inner city.
When we look around the mall today, it is a largely white crowd. You are non-white.
No.
And so I wonder why you came and how you square all the ways that Donald Trump talked about immigration and Latinos with your decision to I'm going to guess, vote for him and support him by showing up today at the mall.
Yeah, because I relate with him. I know what he wants. He wants people to work and working, you know, everybody, this country be united, and he wants everybody to have a job. If you don't have a job, you don't have an identity. A human being without a job, you know, doesn't have an identity, you know. So he wants that. I mean, I work very hard. You know, I was a single mother, and I work hard. And then now I'm well off because on my own, I have two houses that are paid off because I work so hard. America was beautiful. I respect the system. It's like a going to the line, you know. And you get somewhere. Now it's not like that. Millennials, if you see some of the millennials, they want everything free to hand it to them. That's disgusting.
So you want everyone else to follow the right steps the way you did.
The system, the America system, we don't have any. I mean, everything is corrupted. It's like a third world country now.
Before I let you go, just because I think it's better if we say that once, like, I'm going to say, like, my name, like, I'm Michael Barbaro, I'm 37, and I live in New York City.
I'm not going to tell you my age.
You don't have to say your age, but can you just say, like, my name is Sonia, and I live in blah, blah, blah.
My name is Sonia Casey, and I live in Fort Washington, Maryland.
We just would start by asking you to sort of say what your name is, and what town you're from, and how old you are.
I'd rather not talk to the New York Times.
Can I just ask you, and you don't have to give me your full name, but can you just tell me who you are and where you're from?
I'm Johnny. I'm living in Arlington right now. I'm in my last year of law school right now.
So I want to ask you really specifically what it is you want Donald Trump to do because of circumstances in your life and things you want to see changed.
He's going to make judicial appointments that are going to be judges who interpret the law in the manner that Justice Scalia advocated, which is where you take the text of the statute that was passed by the House of Representatives, by the Senate, and then by the President, and apply that. A lot of the judges that Barack Obama appointed and that Hillary Clinton likely would have appointed believe in using legislative history.
And you're confident he's going to do that?
Yes, I think when you look at the list of judges that he proposed before the election.
It sounds like you scrutinized it pretty carefully.
Yes, I think judges like Bill Pryor and Diane Sykes would be excellent choices for the Supreme Court of the United States. And with the appointment of Jeff Sessions toward the position of Attorney General, I think that is something that would have been very unlikely if he didn't intend to follow through with that. So I expect that he's going to appoint great judges and great justices to the Supreme Court.
I want to ask you to describe, because this is an audio program, what you're wearing around your shoulders.
Well, I have a flag that says Trump Pence. I have fastened with a 58th inauguration pin. So.
And you got something on your head, too?
Yes, a white Make America Great Again hat.
Yeah, you're decked out.
Mine is just a knit toboggan or beanie. Yeah. As the Northerners call it, with Trump 45th president on it.
Just for our listeners who can't see, I'm gonna read the pin you've got on.
Yeah.
Trump 2016, finally, someone with balls.
Yes.
Anything else?
I think that says it all.
That pretty much says what I think. Yes.
Let's take a break right there, and we'll be right back.
Toxic Prey is the thrilling new installment from number one New York Times bestselling author John Sanford. Lucas Davenport and his daughter Letty team up to track down a dangerous scientist whose latest project could threaten the world. Look for Toxic Prey, available from Putnam, wherever books are sold.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
So that's what Trump voters want and what they expect. So how can he fulfill those hopes? And what are the chances he will fulfill them? I asked three of my colleagues here in the Washington Bureau of the Times to talk through it and to explore how this presidency might succeed. With me are two White House reporters, Maggie Haberman and Michael Shear, and Carl Hulse, who covers Capitol Hill for the Times. Maggie, Michael, Carl, thank you for coming on a very busy inauguration day.
Certainly.
Happy to do it.
So on the wall today, I met a woman named Denise who lost her job working for a Virginia defense contractor because, she said, of sequestration, the automatic cuts that President Obama signed into law while he was in office. And she is convinced that Donald Trump is going to meaningfully restore that spending in a way that would impact her job prospects and people like her. Do we think Donald Trump is actually going to do that? Can he do it?
Well, I was going to let Mike go because he's from Virginia.
I am. And this will be a two-part question with me and Carl, because I think the first part of the answer is I think he'll try. He's said and repeatedly that he wants to increase defense spending. I think he's talked about, without using the awful word sequestration, I think he's talked about getting rid of the automatic cuts and restoring a lot of the funding that was lost and probably affected people like that. To do that is incredibly challenging in an environment where you don't have unlimited resources, and you either have to make deep, deep, deep cuts elsewhere. You have to grow the economy at a pace that, you know, few people think is going to happen really quickly. And all of that has to be done in concert with Congress, which is where Carl comes in, because those folks are not going to just
sort of
do it.
I think they'll get an increase in defense spending. It's been held back for a few years. John McCain wants a big increase. In fact, he's gotten out there with such a big number that, you know, a moderate number will seem okay. I think there's a good chance of it. You know, the way defense spending works, it's a real game. It's spent in every state. So you can, you know, Virginia, Maryland, of course, the people around here actually who, as Trump said, have been profiting while the rest of the country hasn't, by the way, today. But it's in California. It's everywhere. I think that will probably happen in some way. There's going to have to be some trade-off with the Democrats.
So Denise and her husband, TR, both agreed that the Affordable Care Act had real devastating consequences for people around them, either small businesses who couldn't afford to provide it or folks who had insurance through the Affordable Care Act and found the deductible was crushing to them. Now, interestingly, she says, I don't want it repealed, but I just know Donald Trump is going to provide a better plan that's going to make those deductibles more manageable. Carl, starting in Congress, is that realistic? Is she going to get that or her people like
her? I think, you know, there's so many misconceptions about the Affordable Care Act. And certainly premiums have gone up for people, but some of those people couldn't get insurance before. Sure, it's expensive, but it was unattainable prior to the ACA. You know, this is the big struggle. Yeah, we need to change this law that we've despised for 7 years now, but we don't want it to go away, and we don't want to lose pre-existing conditions, and we want our kids to stay. You know, so they're going to have to put something together. There's going to be something at the end of this, and it's hard to see exactly what it's going to be. But you know, right now, I've written this myself, we're back at square one in the struggle to publicly define the Affordable Care Act. The Republicans are still saying it's a disaster and it's, you know, really devastating the healthcare economy, which is probably not true.
Maggie, didn't you talk to Trump on the phone about this very thing, what his ambitions are for healthcare and whether they're going to meet the expectations of people like Denise and her husband?
I would not say that his ambitions, as he laid them out to me, were as precise as something that would answer what Denise and her husband are seeking. And then his longer interview with Bob Costa at the Washington Post was equally nonspecific, but even broader, because what he said was healthcare for everybody. And then that
more
was
broadly nonspecific.
Right. take him literally, not seriously, or the other way around. I can't remember which one it's supposed to be right now. But he doesn't quite know. As you know, Michael, you've covered him. He's not a details-oriented person, especially on areas that are outside his comfort zone, and health policy is one of them. I think Carl is right that we don't know what this is going to look like. I do know that Denise's complaint was one that I heard from a number of voters during the primaries, and it was, I think, a main reason why Trump did well with a broad section of voters, particularly evangelical voters. I remember that Thomas Kaplan and I did a story about Trump's surprisingly strong evangelical support, talked in very stark and angry and sort of betrayed terms about what Obamacare had done to their premiums.
Can I just add one other
Please.
Thing to this? I think for 7 years or whatever it is, 6.5 years since the Obamacare was passed, one of the things that has dogged Obama has been that it's hard to isolate the effects, the things that are happening, and find the cause for those things. So some of these premium increases and the cost of increase in healthcare are things that were going to happen anyway, perhaps even at faster rates than they would have. But when they're happening, people point to Obamacare because they've got a plan through Obamacare.
The insurance companies point to Obamacare
because they don't want to be blamed for the right. fact that they're having to raise rates. But in fact, like, the cost of MRIs has gone through the roof and all of that. The thing that's interesting is that very problem that dogged Obama for all those years is now going to be dogging the Republicans and Trump because they're not going to be able to address it any easier than Obama did.
Well, right. Trump sort of instinctually got that, too, yes. in that tweet yes. where he's saying, hey, we don't want to own this.
Oh, yes.
So. Right. And so they're going to try to do X or Y or Z or whatever they're going to propose, and it's going to turn out that it's not so easy to connect the fixes to the problems, and people are still going to see their, you know, in premiums going up and all of that. And this time it'll be the Republicans that will own that problem.
That was one of the things that Trump, I'm sorry, Carl, that was one of the things that Trump did say to me in that same interview, was he was very clear. He was already looking ahead toward 2018 because, as we have discovered, he is seeing everything about this presidency so far in sort of election cycle chunks. And he said that, you know, I'm going to campaign on this in these red states with Democrats who are up in the Senate. We don't want to own this. We don't want this to be ours. We will make it theirs. That kind of simple language is why he won, in part, and I think it could be effective.
I met a law student named Johnny who expects Trump to pick a Supreme Court nominee who strictly interprets the law according to the Constitution, an originalist in the mold of Antonin Scalia. Is that Trump's actual plan for the first Supreme Court pick? He talks about Antonin Scalia as a legal hero, but is he going to satisfy the expectations of people like Johnny who expect those selections to be originalists?
Well, I think he's going to pick somebody off this list that's been recommended by the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society. I mean, he's already said he's going to take somebody. And a lot of those folks who are on there are considered to be strict constructionists. But, you know, strict constructionists is depending on what you want strictly constructed, you know, they can veer off of that. I assume from your description of him, though, he will embrace the person that Trump nominates.
Yeah, and I think there's little evidence that in this area, this is one of those places that Trump intends to veer very far from the sort of expectations of conservatives. You know, there are some places, obviously, you know, infrastructure spending, for example, where he may be wildly in a different place than where some of the Republicans are. This is one of the Supreme Court, I think, he's going to do sort of down the middle on this one.
I mean, the bigger issue is that the Democrats have said they're not going to go for anyone.
Well, do they have the power, Carl? That was going to be a question.
Yeah,
they do, actually. Can they block it?
Yes, they do. Because in the change of the Senate precedents, which is what actually happened, it's often wrongfully described. I know you want to get into the details of that.
But desperately.
Did not apply to Supreme Court justices. Schumer's already made some noise. Like, why? Because they're furious about Merrick Garland and what the Republicans right. did. And he's already said, you know, we don't have to go along with this. The only way you could change that is to get 60 votes or change the rule and make it apply to Supreme Court nominees. And I don't know that Mitch McConnell's got the votes for that right now. And I don't even know that Mitch McConnell would vote for that right now. So they can hold this up. It's not going to be held up forever, I don't think. But that is one area where they still have filibuster power.
I want to turn to Philip. He's a construction manager who is determined to bring back factory workers in this country. He recalled friends who told him of having to train Mexican workers who would eventually replace them in their own jobs and the trauma of that. Is this an area, for all that Trump has said, and he said it today, and he said it since the beginning of the campaign, where he actually has the power, has the wherewithal, and vision to do something beyond symbolism? Can he actually bring back manufacturing in the United States?
So I think there are certain very, very marginal things that he can do, where I think he is going to run into a massive problem, and I've been thinking about this a lot over the last 2 weeks, is it's not as if the advances in technology and in artificial intelligence, and you're seeing, for instance, robotics, that's not going to help at all. So that it sounds great, but there is a reason that the manufacturing jobs have left, and I'm not sure that they're replaceable. I mean, I think that there will be some numbers that will be boosted, and I think that Trump being Trump will characterize whatever happens in, you know, times five or as different than it actually is. And we've already seen him do that, so I'm not projecting. But I think the reality is that it is going to be much harder for him to deliver than people realize. And this is, to me, the biggest question. When your approval rating is this low, if people feel that their lives are improving and that, you know, jobs are increasing, then I think that he will be secure in his presidency. Mm.
I think this was one of Trump's biggest mistakes. You know, the coal mines are coming back. The steel mills are coming back.
Because he was so definitive about
right.
it. And
they
so
are not
declarative.
Coming back. I mean, you know, you right. can, she's, Maggie's right, you can nibble around the edges, but those industries have just moved on.
Right. And if you spend any time in North Carolina in some of these towns where they used to make furniture or they used to make T-shirts, you know, and the factories are completely shuttered and closed down. I mean, the idea that those industries are coming back in any sort of big way is just ridiculous. The one thing I would say that he, I think, has a chance of at least addressing this a little bit is if tax reform in some form happens and they manage to lower the corporate tax rate, there is a fair amount of untapped American desire to do some stuff in this country that CEOs have been unwilling to do for a lot of years because the tax rate here is a lot higher than mm-hmm. it is in other places. If they manage to lower that and combined with an overall improvement in the economy that's just happening sort of regardless of whatever the president does, it's possible that you'll see some of that kind of happening. The difference is, though, it won't be furniture and T-shirts,
that's right?
Yeah.
right?
It'll be iPhones
that's exactly
and,
right.
you know, whatever. So that guy who you talked to, I'm sorry, Philip, maybe,
yeah.
that guy, it isn't going to be him that's going to get the
yeah,
manufacturing job
really
if it comes
true.
Back. It's going to be somebody coming out of, you know, college with yes. an engineering
or
degree.
Maybe
or
maybe an immigrant with
or an immigrant.
H-B-1
yes.
visa.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right,
so, I mean,
high skilled worker.
It's a much more complicated thing. And to Carl's point, when you, as a presidential candidate, simply make declarative statements that we're going to bring the jobs back. They're all coming back. They're coming back. We're going to get them back. That's hard to follow
yeah,
through.
Yeah, I think he can help keep jobs here, which he's actually doing very effectively right now, and that's probably the thing he can take credit for. But there's some big things coming down the pike, and people are really starting to worry about the driverless car. Millions and millions of Americans are in the
trucking
and driving business.
Right.
And what happens to them? You know, you know, this is a very complex problem, and job training is mm-hmm. probably more mm-hmm. the way to go.
Finally, Philip's wife, Sarah, she's a nurse. She believes, and she was on the mall, she just heard Trump speak. She believes he's uniquely positioned to unify the country, to make Americans take greater pride in being Americans, to take greater pride in their neighbors. And I wonder if that's really his goal. And of course, it's kind of hard to tell sometimes with Trump, but she is convinced that now that he's president, that is his goal. Do you think it is?
I don't know what that means. I mean, I didn't understand what it meant when he said it, frankly. Take pride in your neighbors. I guess that depends on what neighborhood you're in, right? I mean, that fleeting reference to all of us bleeding the same patriotic blue, and he talked about how everybody has the same protections under the law. But I didn't consider this to be a particularly harmonizing or unifying speech where he was suggesting that we all appeal to the better angels of our nature. That might have been the only reference. And again, I mean, I genuinely, in the context of everything else he said, I didn't really understand it.
Well, and you know, ironically, one of the themes of his speech, right? And one of the themes that he's talked about over these last several days is that, you know, he wants people not to just be talkers, but to be people of action, right? Well, that's, if he really wants to unify the country, then it has to be even more than words. Even if he gets the words right on a consistent basis, then you have to ask yourself, what can he do? What legislation can he seek? What actions, executive actions can he take? What can he do to actually say to a conservative who lives in Michigan, in rural Michigan, and a lesbian who lives in San Francisco, you know, how can he bring those two people together without actually taking some action?
I see his problem as something that was extremely evident today. He has a totally different view of America than millions and millions of Americans do. Yes. He sees this nation in decline and everything's bad and, you know, we're crumbling. And Steny Hoyer, I quote him in my piece, you know, says this just isn't true, you know, this dark vision of America. So I don't think he can be a uniting figure when he is so far off of how other Americans see their own country.
Phones go off, Maggie. It happens. Let's turn to Trump's hopes as he articulated them during his inaugural address today. This is what he said.
From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
What does that mean? How can you put that into practice?
It's a phrase with a very negative connotation in American history that our colleague, Mr. Sanger, put in his ear when David and I interviewed him in the first of two foreign policy interviews. Trump seemed completely unfamiliar with it at the time. He later, in our next one, claimed he had known about it and knew its association with Lindbergh and the negativity associated with it.
As an exclusionary phrase.
Yes. And as sort of a sense of bigotry. I mean, it was not just exclusionary. It was beyond that. I mean, it was incredibly nationalistic. I think that Trump doesn't entirely know what it means, frankly. I think that, I don't mean historically.
Or what it connotes still, though. I don't think he does.
I definitely don't think he does. And I think that although I'm not sure that it would bother him. I don't think it would compel him to stop using it, even if people kept saying it to him, because I'm sure people have said that to him. But I think he likes the way it sounds. I think that it is...
branding.
Exactly. And he is all about branding.
But beyond the way it sounds, beyond even the symbolism and the nationalistic meanings through American history, as a policy... guidepost.
It's not a policy guidepost. Yeah,
you're saying
it doesn't mean
it's
anything.
Not.
I guess what I'm saying, that's actually, it doesn't mean anything.
Can I just say, I mean, I don't disagree at all with what Maggie said, but I do think that in this area, I'm not so certain that Trump is that different from a lot of politicians.
I agree with
right?
that.
Especially the best ones, right? They come up with ways to inspire people to move in a certain direction. And sure, at some point you have to fill in the details of that direction or you don't get very far, right? But whether it's hope and change that Obama used, which didn't really mean, I mean, sort of what did that mean, right? I mean, you could sort of say that meant everything and nothing all at the same time. 8 years later, Obama has filled in the details of what he thinks hope and change means. Donald Trump has to do the same thing with America First, and you at least have the possibility that you could build an agenda, right, around where you use that phrase, forgetting the history, the bad history, but you use that phrase as a way to compel people to move in a certain direction. it doesn't mean anything now. The question is, can he make it mean something in the future?
I thought America First was a promise to tighten borders, to renegotiate deals like NAFTA and make sure deals like TPP don't happen, and to wake up every morning as president telling Americans, I negotiate for you. And I don't see a world in which a negotiation that might benefit any foreigner more than you is even conceivable. And I don't think Barack Obama saw the world that way. I think he saw, if we help a foreigner, great. Maybe even if we help a foreigner a little bit more or as much as America, Trump says, no. It's really only about Americans.
I think Obama did think that way.
Yeah.
I think he didn't think that way, and neither does a lot of the rest of the world right now. Right. And we're very intertwined with them. So by doing American first, you may actually come American last because it's going to rebound on you in a major way. Now, having said that, and having been in Canada and Mexico recently, both of those countries would like to see some changes in NAFTA and that they think they've gotten cheated on some of this stuff. So, you know, reopening this, 15 or 20-year-old agreement, trying to get some stuff done there is probably not a bad idea, but, you know, it's so complicated. But you're going to have to build a big wall at the same time down there, right?
Are you guys similarly dismissive, and I think you were a little bit, of America First, of returning power to the people, which is the second major theme and hope of Trump's speech today?
You know, one way that he could really do that he's for is term limits, right? This is something that could change the dynamic in Washington. Never been able to be accomplished. If he got really serious about that, I think he could have an impact. It's a roadblock over there. Mitch McConnell has said flat out, no term limits. But other than that, you know, it's like the people don't have power. They voted in Donald Trump. Still not quite a majority of the people, but...
I do think, though, here's the other thing, and this may help to explain in some ways why he takes the sort of very... angry approach, populist approach that he's taking, which is that his power derives from the idea that he's not just another politician. And the minute that he becomes just another politician in Washington, then the tweet that he sends doesn't compel Congress to act the it did on the ethics thing.
He's the agent of the people.
Exactly. So to the extent that people like Steve Bannon and others in his sort of inner circle are pushing him to, you know, do these things that sort of make all of us in the Washington establishment feel uncomfortable and on edge. And, you know, how could he say that? That's just not said. You know, part of that is to keep that connection, or that at least people think there's that connection to this movement. He's a movement, not a politician. And so he'll continue to have power.
For the record, Maggie and I are from the New York establishment. I want to end with a note of optimism here. What in your mind would a successful Trump presidency look like? Hulse.
Okay, I'll go first. I think if he could get a pretty decent infrastructure public works bill through, keep some continue with this effort to keep jobs in the country with... Trust me, a lot of Democrats are quietly loving that, honestly. Not get us into some terrible overseas adventure, make some terrible foreign policy mistake, and maybe make some budget adjustments. You know, the federal budget is a mess. There's a lot that could be done there to reshape it. You know, I think that, to me, if he could pull that off and stabilize the tax laws a little bit, I think that could be successful. It's more like, what is he not going to do? If he's not going to go too far backwards on some things, right? You know, what happens with social policy? And that's a whole different area.
I think the infrastructure bill in particular will be very compelling to a lot of people, and it will be pretty co-opting for Democrats and make it really hard to criticize him.
And he will be bipartisan,
which will
feel successful.
Or maybe too Democratic.
Right. I was very struck watching at the congressional luncheon how sort of schmoozy he was with Schumer in particular. And then even before that, when he was signing the nominations for his cabinet appointees, he really likes Nancy Pelosi, and he has a relationship with Nancy Pelosi before this. I'm very interested to watch him sort of sell these people because he knows he has the GOP leadership and he doesn't need to worry about them right now. He is always reading a room and looking at who he has to sell next, and that's where he is.
Michael.
So putting aside the specifics of policy, right, because I think people's presidencies can be successful in a Democratic-leaning way and a Republican-leaning way. We have successful presidencies that take different directions in policy. I think he could do two things that could end up making him successful. One would be to end gridlock. I mean, if he can really find it, it is really a persistent underlying part of what frustrates the American people with our political system writ large is this idea that we just never get anything done. And then the second thing is if he, and this is to Carl's point about what is he not doing rather than what he's doing, can he avoid being dragged down these sort of rabbit holes of anger and hate? And those two things, avoiding the bad and getting some progress, that's a message that could work for a re-election campaign.
Michael, Maggie, Carl, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Promise you'll come back in 4 years.
Will we be relaunching the run-up then?
And we will look back and see if we were right. Now the hard work begins for President Trump as he reconciles his hopes and those of his supporters with the hopes of the entire country. It's a high-stakes balancing act. And as our former president, Barack Obama, said, we're all now rooting for his success. Before we end here, a quick personal note. As I said at the beginning of the show, this is my last episode as the host of The Run-Up. We started this show in August to cover the general election, and we planned on ending it after. But you told us you liked it, and we liked you, so we kept putting out this show. It won't go away just because I'm not the host. It will take a quick hiatus, and we'll return with a new host based out of Washington because the story and the spotlight are now here. And when it picks back up, I'll be listening right alongside you from New York, where I'm starting a new audio project that I will tell you all about in just a few days. I'm enormously grateful to you, our loyal listeners. Thank you very much for coming on this journey with me. The Run-Up is a production of the New York Times. Our executive producer is Lisa Tobin. Samantha Hennig is our editorial director. Our show producer is Vanessa Romo. Pedro Rosado is our engineer. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Special thanks to two people who helped make this show a reality, Sam Dolnick and Carolyn Ryan, and to all of my colleagues, reporters, columnists, and editors at the Times who appeared on the show week after week. Thank you all.
Looking for a new ride? Shop for your next car from the comfort of your home, 100% online with Carvana. Carvana has a massive inventory, including thousands of cars under $20,000. So finding a car that fits your budget and lifestyle is hassle-free. Carvana makes car financing hassle-free. Get pre-qualified in minutes by answering a few quick questions. Carvana also offers customizable terms and payments as low as $0 down, because payment plans should fit your plans. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to find your next car without ever leaving the comfort of home or anywhere else. Terms and conditions may apply.